This is Remote Ruby.
Have you any remote ideas to the meaning of the word?
What's up, Andrew?
Yo. What's good?
Oh, it's been a long week, but we've had finally some delays in our house. Half our windows came in, and then apparently the other half our windows are not coming in soon. No one told us the deadline of when they're coming. So yeah, things are starting to get exciting, I guess.
That's good. It's been a long week for me as well. We shipped a new project at work that I've been working on for the past few months.
Hey.
And just so happy to be done with it, honestly.
Has it gone smoothly into production?
So smoother than I thought, because I mean, which has not been a typical project that I'm used to working on. We've had a few bumps in the road. But before it launched, me and my buddy John Espinoza, who's on Twitter, you can find him. He and I were pairing like all day long, every day, just beating bugs. So it was an hour prior to the launch that the official email was going to be out that this was ready to go. And this is an internal product to only people that work with our company. So it's not like we're about to get a massive influx of like people from Twitter or something. So the load was never the issue. It was just like, we kept finding like little things here and there because of like some new tools that we were using that made things a lot more difficult that I'm not going to discuss right now. It just kind of made things a little bit more painful. So John and I were banging bugs like up until an hour before the launch. And we're trying to get something out the door waiting for Heroku to build. And I put on the final countdown and we were able to test it and completely ship it like 20 minutes before the official launch. So we just kind of wiped her forehead. So far, pretty much so good. There's been a few small things that we've had to fix, but we were able to just get so much done, find so many things and fix them like for the prior week. This has been a more hectic project than usual. And so I've never had to do that where the week up to the launch, we're just bug squashing as quickly as possible. But it happened this time and it is what it is, but successful launch. Had a few communication things that we've had to clear up, which is always like another part of launching a product that you never really think about when you're like building it is like, okay, but I've got a support team that needs to know how to support this. And then I've got people need to know how to use this and there needs to be training on this and that. And there's all these other things that you got to think about and coordinate with other people with. And it's just a lot of communication that you kind of forget about when you're in the middle of banging out that last bug or two for it to go live. And then suddenly it goes live and you're like, oh, we forgot to tell so-and-so about this. So it's, yeah, it's interesting to see what kind of falls to the side when you get into crunch time.
Right. It's interesting that you're talking about that because having worked for myself for the past 7 years or whatever, I don't have crunch time like that anymore because I have my own schedule, but I remember those a lot. And I'm kind of going through a little bit of one right now where like I've just been postponing the launch of the new Hatchbox as we like figure out little things here and there that we'd like to fix or whatever. But there are a lot of those things like the communication stuff. Like I was just thinking, how do we actually tell all the existing users that like, hey, that version's going to stay around. You can happily keep using that. We're going to maintain it, whatever, but we're not going to add new features. And the big thing for me was actually, you know, like I set up the marketing site and the app all on hatchbox.io. And now I got to kind of replace that domain with the new app. So I think I'm going to do like maybe, I don't know, maybe I just point the www and the root domain to the new app. But all of the webhooks, I have to go back and replace with the new classic.hatchbox.io or something. And that one should not cause any issues. I swapped my own apps over yesterday and it was fine. Basically, it's a new DNS record, one update to GitHub or whatever, and that's pretty good. So I think it should be seamless, but it's one of those ones where like there are a lot of other little things to worry about when you launch a new thing like that, like communicating with users and whoever else. It's a lot.
Yeah. And like going back to the DNS thing, so I think we were trying to purchase like a new domain for this site, which is not something we typically use, a subdomain for everything, but trying to use a new domain. And what happened is that it was not done propagating the DNS records to the Heroku app by the time launch. So that, unfortunately, we had to delay a little bit, but that propagation took longer than I'd ever seen DNS take before. So I don't understand why that was. Yeah, but that's something you also have to consider. Okay, we're ready to put this on the live URL like tomorrow or today and it's going to go live. Don't forget about your certificates and stuff because that could take longer. And if your website, if your users are going to an unsecured website, or it's like redirecting you to the Heroku app or something like that. These are things you got to think about.
That's a great point. I don't know. There's little things like you could set up Cloudflare SSL wrong and like it's very strict about the certain mode. They serve SSL, but they expect your app to be in HTTP. Because like I've done that where I've set up a domain and then I get an infinite SSL redirect because of Cloudflare being like very strict about it. And yeah, that's a great point. You need to like quietly launch like an hour early or whatever so that like you can test it all, make sure it all works. And it has to be live at that point, but you can't really test DNS before you change it. So,
I mean, you could turn off like the ability to log in or something. There's things you could do to mitigate that. Like an hour before was like, we did have it set up more than an hour before and still didn't finish propagating. So you might even want to consider the day before or the night before. Let's get this ready to go. Which it's no one's fault or anything. No, it's not this bad thing happened. It's just like, it is what it is. Like DNS propagates, it does its thing. Like we have no control over it. So it's more so like a lesson for the future. Okay, maybe we should think about doing this a little bit sooner.
If you were a developer at Facebook when they had all the DNS issues, is that what you'd be saying? Like, I don't have any control over it. Like,
it's just DNS, this happens, bro. Yeah, we can't do anything about this. You know, propagation has to propagate. I don't know. I just know these words. I don't.
Yeah, it's one of those like kind of, I don't know. It feels like a mystery when you're like learning it for the first time. You're like, how in the world does any of this connect? Like the other day, I was helping Andrew Hodson on Hauling Buddies and he was having trouble with like images that weren't showing up. As it turns out, Spectrum had basically flagged NYC3 on DigitalOcean Spaces as unsafe for all of their customers. So weirdly, like I'm on Spectrum too, and I was able to go and see the images, but then I went down the street to my sister-in-law's house and I couldn't get it from her network. And I was like, what?
Oh, that's insane.
Yeah, like it took us a long time to figure out, okay, the request seems to work and everything on my end, but not his, which means that it's like something to do with his network or ISP or whatever. And we eventually traced it down to like every single request going there on his machine would just hang infinitely. Like it didn't give you an error message or anything. It just ran and ran and ran and ran. And we realized, okay, maybe it's something to do with DigitalOcean or the network for Spectrum or whatever. And changing his DNS to the 1.1.1.1 from Cloudflare or Google DNS, both of those worked immediately. And we're like, well, that pretty much narrows it down that it's got to be the ISP. I mean, those are like weird ones to fix because you're like, that's surely the last thing that would break. And it wasn't like DNS. It was just the ISP had blocked stuff internally. So we didn't know that. But have you ever done like a trace route and stuff like that? You know,
since college.
Yeah, I remember doing that too in college. We had a course on that and I pretty rarely, but occasionally whip that out to try and figure out what the heck is going on with this network request. And it's surprisingly, impressively rare that you have to do that at least. But
I use this app called ProxyMan. What it does is it captures all the requests coming in and out of your machine, which is also a great way to find out what the heck is spying on you. And that's one way I've also used to like get finer tracing of what is coming in and out of this app and what are the headers, things like that. That's if you want like a GUI, it's a really powerful tool that I use.
Yeah, I like that. I keep seeing, what is it, Glasswire or something that is a sponsor on Linus Tech Tips. And I've seen that too. It's a great idea being able to just monitor all your network traffic that's going on because who knows what apps are making network requests in the background and stuff. So cool to keep an eye on those things.
So I heard, speaking of Macs, you got a new Mac. Congratulations.
I did. If it wasn't so fast, I would consider it, but just barely.
Understandable.
It is screaming fast. Like, you know, I'm used to compiling Ruby on like a Core i7 on my iMac or my MacBook Pro. And I think I got the iMac a year or two ago and the MacBook Pro 2 years ago. And I can't believe how fast it is. Like it compiled Ruby in 2 minutes or less. It was just super fast. And I've been trying to do no Rosetta stuff. Like I would love for everything that I'm running to run natively on Apple Silicon, but for people who don't know, the like Rosetta, it's just a compatibility layer between all the Apple Silicon stuff and basically your old Intel x86 architecture stuff so that you can run these older apps on that. They're compiled for it. It works fine, but it'll be a little bit slower because it's going through and being translated. And like I installed Discord and that was one where it was like, hey, you're going to need Rosetta for this. But I installed Ruby, I installed Postgres, Redis, you name it, all of those, the homebrew compiled natively. They're just lightning fast. I mean, it's so snappy. Browser's super fast. It is great. It's really bulky though. Like I got the 16 inch and it's much squarer as a shape. And it reminds me of the MacBook Pros from 5 years ago or something because it is hefty.
How much better is the keyboard?
Well, I'm pretty happy with the 2019 one that I have. Like it's nice.
Butterfly? Or was that the one where they switched away? I have a butterfly keyboard and it's...
Okay. Yeah, and I think 2019 was the one where they like went back to the better keyboard.
Okay.
This keyboard's better than that one, I would say. It reminds me just like the old ones. No touch bar feels a little weird.
Screw that touch bar.
But I love it.
That
I don't really use the touch bar for anything. So,
I mean, I normally type with an external keyboard. So,
and this is what I really want to do. I primarily record screencasts on the MacBook so I can record anywhere. So then I'm going to take a ScreenFlow video that I recorded. We can talk about this a little bit. But I just recorded a pair programming session with Casper about reviewing a Rails PR. And that was like an hour of us talking and just exploring, you know, the feature in Rails. And I'm going to export that on the 2019 MacBook Pro and then copy it over to the M1. And I got the M1 Max with the base configuration on that. So like 32 gigs of RAM, terabyte storage, whatever. And I'm going to export that same screencast on both of them and time it and see how long it takes. Because I bet you that it's like half the time on the new one. That's mainly the reason why I was like going to buy one. Because really, I work mostly on my iMac on a desktop. So it's like really hoping that they were going to come out with a new iMac. But seems like that will be a new, waiting for a new chip or something. But you have HDMI ports again. You have an SD card slot again.
Headphone jack. They don't even have that on the phone.
And it's a headphone jack that does the, what do they call those mics?
Spatial audio.
I know Xavier just tweeted about it. It was the like high impedance headphones. So like super high quality headphones are, I guess, high impedance. And so that's, I guess, built in now, which is pretty cool. But I'm a layman when it comes to high quality headphones. I don't need all that yet.
So, and you don't use Docker, right?
I do, but I try and avoid it.
Have you used it at all on your new one?
I have not installed it on the new M1 yet.
It's still sacred. It's still clean and pure. Yeah. I have a new developer on my team and he has a new M1 Mac. And I think he's the first one I've really worked with that has a new one. And we've run into a few things here and there that are like, that's really annoying. And I think he is using CHRuby because that is apparently the one that works best on the M1s. I don't know why, but that's what the internet says.
I used ASDF, which just uses Ruby build. So
that's what I use.
And I think CHRuby uses Ruby build behind the scenes too, right? Or
really?
Maybe not. RBM does at least, but...
Yeah, RBM definitely does.
Probably doesn't.
Big ASDF user. I use everything with ASDF on my main computer, like Postgres, Redis, Elastic.
Oh, nice. I just use it for languages.
No, I use it for Postgres too.
That's cool. Yeah. So what's the issues you've seen there?
This might have been a CHRuby thing, but we couldn't install like Ruby 2.6.3.
Okay.
So we couldn't install that for some reason. We couldn't really figure out why. And then you're trying to build things in Docker. And for some reason that was failing. And I was like, which was really boggling my brain because I was like, I thought the whole point of Docker was that it works everywhere. And I was like, but here I am watching this not run on your machine, but run on my machine. And that completely breaks my entire mental model of how Docker works. And now I'm confused and lost and alone.
Yeah, you would think that Docker itself would have to be the issue then. Because in theory, everything that runs inside of it should be different. But
well, and I know they had those issues with Docker and M1 support in the very beginning. And it's kind of looking like it's not fixed still yet. Because like he's trying to install certain Linux libraries inside of this Docker container and it wasn't working. And I was like, this shouldn't even be a thing. What do you mean it's not working?
Yeah, I guess it kind of depends on how Docker actually executes stuff. Because it does say under the For Apple Silicon Docker page, not all images are available for ARM64. You can add platform Linux AMD64 to run an Intel image under emulation. So for example, like the MySQL image is not available for ARM64 right now.
And we use MySQL. Oh yeah, he had to use MariaDB.
Yeah, which I think we've talked about in the past. It's an alternative, but it is not perfect of an alternative as claimed.
Well, when he said that, he's like, I couldn't use MySQL. And I was like, you couldn't use MySQL? What? And he's like, I had to use MariaDB. I was like, no, not that one.
Yeah.
I've heard about that one.
So that's interesting. It must be trying to use everything as ARM if it can, I guess. So that'll be fascinating. I was upgrading an old app or tried to run it on the M1 and it was Ruby 2.7. But what I ran into was the AppSignal C extension wouldn't compile.
Ah,
and it actually, well, maybe it compiled, I think. All the bundle install ran. But when I tried to run Rails console or Rails DB migrate or anything, it would load the AppSignal extension and then instantly segfault Ruby. And so then poking around, they've updated their C extension for that and it works now. So I think that's going to be probably an issue with things. And then I don't know if older OpenSSL or anything like that will even compile on that as well. So you may have a real trouble with older Ruby versions. But from what I ran, Rails 2.7, Rails 3, those were just fine. So it's like I booted up GoRails, Jumpstart, all that stuff was like just lightning fast. I was impressed.
Well, when I was looking at this, I was like, okay. So he was like, it doesn't work on Ruby 2.7.3, it works on 2.7.4. And I was like, cool, that's okay. We can just upgrade. That's a fine upgrade to do. That we can do that. But when it was coming to the things failing inside the Docker images, and I was just like,
Right. When Docker's promise is that it can run on any machine agnostically, and then it doesn't, you're like, what am I using this for? What value here?
Everything I believed is a lie. And I felt like this really crashed my mental model of what was happening because I was trying to rationalize in my head like how this could be a thing. And it was just,
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, you reminded me of the older app that I was working on this week. We had the weirdest thing. So we have this app that has a small Ember application inside of it. And I was trying to upgrade it to Ruby 3 and it was node 10 and like we're at node 16 now for LTS and stuff. And I was like, I'm just going to go try and get through the dependencies and update those and stuff. And as I was going through the test suite, making sure that things were still passing, there was a warning from SCSS that was like, oh, hey, this is going to be deprecated. You can just use this instead. So I like, along with these other things, just made that change, cleaned up the warning and moved on. And it was like an add extend feature for basically adding a class into another class or whatever. And I made that change. And later on, I realized that like something was happening where things would just hang indefinitely. There were a few times where I woke up in the morning and CI had been running for 6 hours before GitHub Actions killed it. You know, you would run the test suite locally and sometimes it would work, but then other times it would get through like 12 tests and then just pause forever. And you would boot up the Rails server and you'd open up like the homepage and it would render and get to a certain point and then hang forever. And I was like, what in the world happened here? And it turns out it was that like weird SAS change that I made. It was like, didn't give me an error, no messages or anything, but it just hung forever. And I was like losing my mind for several days trying to figure out what happened here. It was such a simple like change in the warning that I was like, surely it can't be that. And sure enough, it was. It was weird to deal with some of those issues sometimes. It feels similar to a lot of the things you experience. Like you switch to the M1, like just things you expected to be fine kind of magically aren't for a little while. And then hopefully some of them get fixed or whatever. And I started looking at the docs for SAS and it was like, yeah, this is available in Dart SAS, but not Node SAS or Lib SAS or whatever. So I think it was one of those things where it got half updated or something, but not completely. I don't know.
I just ran into something very similar with SAS where something was deprecated and it wasn't working and we couldn't figure out why, but it was working over in this app and this app is running the same thing. And we're like, that doesn't make any sense. How can two apps be running the same thing and one of them work and one of them not? And it was some deprecation SaaS. And we're still like kind of dealing with that ramification of whatever upgraded that introduced this change, like it was unexpected. The first time we saw it, we were like, what is this? And it's like SaaS. And like, we haven't upgraded this library. Why is SaaS failing here? Just weird.
That's interesting.
If you're listening to this podcast, then who's making sure that your application is running correctly? Is the app up? Are bugs plaguing your users? Do your cron jobs execute correctly? I don't have to worry about this because I have a secret weapon, Honey Badger. Honey Badger works with my unique workflow, is easy to set up on all my projects, and gives me peace of mind throughout the day. The best part is that Honey Badger has all the tools I need in an easy to understand UI with excellent documentation. I want to build features, not waste time trying to configure my tools, and Honey Badger provides that for me out of the box. Sign up for Honey Badger today and let them know we sent you. Thanks to Honey Badger for their continued support of the show.
Related to that, I had run into like, where was it? Oh, is it Ember CLI Rails gem, which is being used for this tiny Ember app. And I remember seeing a handful of these, but it's been a little while since Ruby 3 came out, but it hasn't been updated in quite some time. And so it's got, I think, 4 method calls, I believe, that are taking the keyword args and using the double asterisk, but then it passes them on to another method call without the double asterisk, and it just blows it up with an error on Ruby 3. And I was like, why can't we just merge this or whatever? It just reminded me that GitHub is great and everything, but there's still no solution to how do we take an abandoned project like this and just keep maintaining it? You know, like, how do you do that? I wish there was like a better, I don't know, something that could flag the project that was like, okay, this is needs maintainers, and it would be built into GitHub or something to help guide you, like, this person's fork is being maintained, so use that or whatever. And we're just having a sort of a easy way to elect somebody to now maintain it instead of weird conversations under issues or something. Cause I was like, you know, I can use this guy's fork, but then what if we need some of the other PRs as well? So it's really best if I just fork the fork and then merge the other PRs in together. And now I got to maintain this other thing. And I just felt there's got to be some way to make that better, that whole process of transferring maintainership or something.
You know what I do? I go up to the forks tab and then I see if any of the forks have been starred. And if any of the forks if they've been starred at all, that's where I start looking. But
I like that.
You're right. It is interesting. Like, I'm sure like adding an ability for like this project needs a maintainer would be something easy for GitHub to add. But like when you start getting into people like voting to replace the maintainer, you get into like an area where it's not like a true solution across the board. Because what if one group of people like take over a project when they're not supposed to, you know? Or so there's right. Like all these weird like things you got to, I can see that being super tricky, but like just making like for a checkbox that's like looking for maintainer and making it easy to like have that conversation would be great from GitHub.
Yeah, that would be...
past that, it gets kind of sketchy.
Yeah, I think that's the big thing is the trust there is the hardest thing to figure out. I don't know. It feels like there's got to be some way of like, look, this person is maintaining other Ruby gems or whatever. If it says needs maintainer, they could click a button and submit their proposal. Hey, I'm maintaining these libraries and I have interest in helping out on your project or whatever. It would be nice if there was an easy way to just throw your hand in there and say, hey, you know what? I may not know Ember very well, but I'm happy to merge a few of these PRs and review them and just make sure that this library still continues on or whatever, or helps these people who are trying to update Ruby versions or whatever. Because at this point, I think our best solution on this is just going to be, it's not very big anyways, but I think we're just going to drop it and replace it with the Hotwire and just rewrite the thing. It's really very similar to the Go Rails like episodes page where you can filter by free or paid or a topic or something. So for the most part, like we can just wire those up with stimulus and make Rails.ajax requests, or rather request.js requests, so that we can use Hotwire to replace those elements on the page with Turbo Streams. I'd like to update all the dependencies before I go into the rewrite of things, but I don't think that's going to be it's not going to be worth it for me to go and fork this library, pull in these random PRs from different people just to get up to Ruby 3 before we do that. So I don't know, kind of strange, but it's one of those ones where I know that I feel like over time, when you're building a Rails app, the more dependencies you pull in, the more you need to realize that you're now the maintainer of all of those libraries. So like, you know, Devise doesn't get updated for Rails 7 right away, then guess what? It's on you. If you want to go upgrade to Rails 7 or whatever, like you're going to maintain a fork for yourself and for your app. And then maybe you can finally get rid of that, but maybe you keep it in there too long and then you've got now a branch of Devise that you didn't really want to maintain. So it's a weird thing, but I feel like there's something there. Someone can figure out how to make that better.
Every time you add a gem, it's like an amount of code debt that you need to like be aware of. I mean, we've talked about this before. I'm not going to like rehash all of it, but when I was a first, you know, beginning developer, they're like, yeah, add Bootstrap Devise views to your gem file and things like that. But like, you know, as you progress through the years, you realize that the more dependencies you have, the harder it is to do other things. And that adding a dependency is like, it's a big decision. It's not just something willy-nilly that you can just do anymore. So there needs to be discussions, and you should kind of just assume that every single gem you add, you may have to maintain yourself. I mean, outside of probably Rails, but you should consider that this is now code in your app. So now you're responsible for it moving forward. Like you can't just go demand that someone release their gem. They may not do it. So yeah,
right. you may not be able to be a maintainer of it either.
Right.
Like they may just have disappeared and won't respond to those. So it is what it is. I also think there's an aspect there of like, so my philosophy in Jumpstart Pro and Go Rails and all this stuff now is basically I like to see the essence of, say, for example, Devise two-factor and see how the two-factor authentication works. But at the end of the day, when you pull in a gem like that, they are required to be configurable, right? So they need to support Twilio and Vonage and whoever else allows text messages or whatever the case is. And then people ask for more configuration options, more extensions, more like little things. And you end up with oftentimes these gems that are tied to a lot of maybe other dependencies with specific versions, or you run into like they're tied to some Rails configuration and you can't really easily upgrade them without making a change to the gem, or you can't upgrade Rails or Ruby sometimes without changing the gem. And I found like a lot of times I would rather do it the sort of Basecamp way. Let's just build it from scratch in our app. We can use the open source version to see the maybe architecture or direction roughly that we might want to go, but we can then tailor it minimally to exactly like what we need. And it makes it easier to upgrade things. I think the two-factor auth in Jumpstart is like a concern and a controller, and none of it is tied to Rails. Maybe there's a Ruby syntax change that happens, but you know, it's in our code base. We can easily fix that if so. So it's kind of nice in those cases where it's a small feature like two-factor auth to grab that. But then also there's times where like Devise sessions and all that and getting that correct, I don't mind using Devise and it's well maintained. And so I'm gonna still use that and pull it in. But a lot of these other libraries, I try to, can I get by with my minimal version? But otherwise, maybe it's something really useful. Like I don't want to deal with typecasting for JSON B columns. So I'll pull in one of those gems for that for sure. I don't want to do that from scratch, but you know.
That's so weird. Well, you don't want to do that from scratch? Why? That's so weird.
I did one time naively try and make a PR to Rails that was like, hey, this new attributes API in Rails 5, why don't we just merge them with the JSONB like store accessor things?
Uh-oh.
And it was like, yep, this has been tried 5 different times and it's more complicated than you understand. So no. And I was like, fair enough.
Fair enough. Fair enough. When I get messages like that, I kind of just,
whoo,
close one. Someone saved me a lot of trouble and heartache.
Totally. It's interesting because a lot of that stuff is way more complicated than it seems on the surface. I just talked with Casper for an hour yesterday. That'll be a Go Rails screencast. That'll be pretty interesting. So Rails 7 is going to have unsafe URL protection in redirects out of the box, which basically means it just won't allow you to redirect to a different domain. That's about it. So if the request came in to example.com and you tried to redirect to google.com or some malicious site, it's going to just raise an error, which is nice. But there is a PR that came up that was exposing one of the internal methods to check, is this URL safe to redirect to? And Casper and I sat and talked for an hour of what does safe mean? And what is this method actually doing? And can there be a more clear way? Because the example is kind of like when you do a sign-in, a lot of times you will have a redirect to so you can go back to the page that you were trying to access. So if someone's malicious, they can link you to the sign-in page that redirects you to their domain, and they could put that in the param in the URL. So the example was basically showing that you could check if the param is safe to redirect to and then use it, or you could use the root URL or whatever as a fallback. And we were just talking through this whole thing about like, what does safe mean? And what if it is more like, instead of asking a question like that returns true or false, what if it was a presence method? So you know how you can call .present on a variable, but you can also use variable.presence, which will return either the value or nil, and then you can kind of chain it. So you could say, either give me a safe redirect to from the param or the root URL, and it would read a little bit better instead of a conditional and stuff. And then it was fun because we were talking about it and we were like, what does this mean anyways? Really, we just want to check, is this an internal URL or not? And then maybe we end up with like internal redirect to or external redirect to where it's explicit which one you want to allow or something. And we didn't come to a conclusion, but it was a fun conversation of like the nuances to your code. We can try and figure out what's the clearest way to explain this little feature. Because also he was saying, if you get this right in Rails, or if you get it wrong in Rails, you're offloading the effort into all these other people's brains. And it could have just been a little extra hour or two of conversation and fixing it and doing it properly inside of Rails where it's more clear. And I was like, that's a great point. Because if you don't do it clearly in Rails, that's going to now be the developer's responsibilities. And you're going to be wasting hundreds of thousands of developer hours potentially trying to have them figure it out, what the meaning of what is safe or whatever in this context. I thought that was a fun conversation because the Rails core team does a very good job about naming, I think, which I want to get better at. I do a good enough job a lot of times, but I always feel like I could have done a better job. And I thought this was a fun one to like explore as a small piece of things. And I got to poke around the redirect. There's like a module just for redirection like this. And it's pretty concise, but this is where all of that code is. And I was like, yeah, this is fun to like read through to see how Rails, first of all, it generates the URL. So like you can redirect to a path or like a full URL. And it's able in there, there's a tiny little snippet of code that looks for a scheme like HTTP. And then it assumes that you have a full URL and then it uses URI parse. But if it's a relative path, it actually appends your host with port in the scheme at the beginning and then sends it to URI to validate. And I was like, oh, this is tiny and simpler than I thought. Rails is not magical. So it was a fun thing I did this week.
That sounds really interesting. And it sounds like if you're not a subscriber to Go Rails, you should go to gorails.com so you can watch that video.
Boom.
Boom. I did.
Hashtag sponsored.
Hashtag sponsored. Hashtag go Rails. Hashtag killers. That's cool. That sounds really interesting. I'm excited to watch that. But you didn't decide, right? So what state did that?
It basically was like, we came up with some good ideas and then we're like, we pretty much just need to sleep on it. We're going to write up kind of what we thought, some ideas, and then just let it rest. Give it some time. Like we don't need to ship this right away. There's nothing critical about it. Ideally, it comes out before Rails goes into RC and you can't change this stuff. But it was like, well, you know what? If there's no rush on it, let's sleep on it, see if other ideas come to mind. But at least it seems like a good direction or whatever, like in clarity on that. So yeah, I thought that was a really good conclusion too, because it was like, you know what? You don't have to solve the problem every time you sit down to work on something. And I was like, yeah, I always feel like guilty if I don't solve it before I walk away. That's not how it should be. You should be able to sit down and think through it and then give it time. So I thought it was good.
Cool. Well, I'm excited to see that. I'm sure many people are. That'll be cool.
Yeah. It'll be up next week, I think. Did you see the KubernetesRails.com website tutorial thingy?
I have not. Although, like we've discussed, my trust is a little bit low with Docker right now. And as extension Kubernetes. You say KubernetesRails.com?
Kubernetes-Rails.com. Yeah. It is a really awesome, thorough tutorial that's just straightforward. Here's all the steps one by one. Go set up your Kubernetes cluster, set up a Rails app, create a simple Docker image for it, build it, run it, then set up your kubectl and all that and all your wonderful YAML files. But I thought it was a nice, perfect domain, honestly. Like that's the best thing for a tutorial like this. So I'm excited. I'm going to go through it and just see how it goes and everything.
Yeah, it's cool. It kind of gives me anxiety when I read it, but that's only been in this world before. I'm like, oh my God, what if you forget a step? The problem with tutorials like this is always that the example is just so simple that it doesn't help you with other stuff. If it doesn't show you how to run Sidekick or Redis.
Which it does. This one's good because it goes through all of that
stuff. Oh yeah, it does.
It goes into migrations and continuous delivery and a little bit, for the most part, like the monitoring and security updates are kind of, here's things to think about, but not necessarily tutorials on that piece. But, you know, it's more complete than I would have expected because a lot of the Medium tutorials or dev.2 ones are all like, here's how to get it running, but never how to maintain it.
And yeah, it's too simple. This one looks a lot better. I also like how they brought up like some things to consider at the very end of it.
Yeah. And you really want like, okay, this is enough to get you started. But the reality is this is day one, but there's not stuff about days 2 through 3,000 or whatever, where you're really maintaining this and you have issues with your pods or whatever, and you need to go restart them or completely reset things or whatever. And that's the maintenance, actually running stuff in production is, I think, where most of these tutorials kind of end. And maybe this will end up getting a lot more of that stuff, but I thought it looked like it did a pretty thorough job of diving through a lot of that.
Yeah, this is really nice. I know what newsletter this might be on this weekend.
Yeah, there you go.
I specifically like he mentioned the database because that's always been this thing in Docker and Kubernetes that like has been debated fiercely and I've never heard like a consensus on it. But I like how he discusses that at the end of this where if you host your database on a single server, it can become a bottleneck. So like, how do you handle that when you're using Kubernetes? So yeah, this looks fantastic. Thanks for showing me this.
Yeah, I thought it would be a good one for anybody that's interested. And a lot of those things like the database stuff is like, well, that's a very different system than a web application itself that can be, you know, we can slap in 15 different web servers really quickly, but like your database server's got to, you can't just take it down and replace it like you could with a web server. So it's one of those where in general, I think their recommendation is just use a managed database from AWS or DigitalOcean. They all offer those for that specific purpose because you're going to need replicas. You're not going to probably want to go figure out how the heck to set up TLS and have a secure connection for Redis because I don't think Redis has an SSL like option built in like other databases. So let DigitalOcean or AWS or whomever take care of those things. You just focus on your Rails app and you're going to pay a few dollars extra for the management, but it'll be worth it because that's not DevOps work that you have to do or a DevOps like employee you have to have. So,
yeah. I mean, yeah, that's something that we're kind of going through and thinking about right now. And one thing that my boss said very eloquently is that like we're Rails developers. We want to find a solution that empowers us to write Rails, not that one that forces us to be working on DevOps like too much. one thing you really need to consider when you're thinking about all this and the costs associated with it is like, if my team is full of Rails developers, I want to use a solution that can help me and my team versus if you have DevOps people and you're at that scale, then yeah, please do that. But if you're not, like maybe Kubernetes isn't for you. It sounds really cool. I want to go refactor our whole infrastructure, but I'm not going to do that. But it's just, if just use the tools that empower your team to do the best work that they can do, aka Hatchbox.
Yeah, that's one where like I enjoy a lot of the DevOps stuff. And you may have people like that on your team, in which case like you're lucky and you can go do more of that on your own. But if you can avoid it when you don't have a DevOps person or someone who's super excited about it, then yeah, that's the right answer. Because
yeah,
as someone who's run Hatchbox, that is a nightmare to maintain because literally every dependency you ever have will change and break on you within 3 months or something. Like it's just a never ending thing. Like the new Ubuntu version, new packages, like Kadi new version or Nginx or whatever. Just the guaranteed thing is that it's going to change and it's going to break.
What I will say is that if you do have one developer in your team that's, I really like DevOps and I want to go do DevOps stuff, just consider what happens when they leave, please. Because if they build your entire infrastructure and then they leave, then what are you going to do? So obviously, like you should always be preparing for that situation and distributing knowledge across your team. But still, if that person's gone, there will be a loss and there will be things that aren't transferred over. So just consider that as well. If you're thinking like, should we go fancy or should we go simple? Like, come on, if you're not running Amazon and or this new portal or Meta, whatever freaking Facebook is trying to change to hide from their crimes, then maybe, yeah, maybe you need to spin up some Kubernetes pods. But other than that, I would just consider using some manage software and don't get fancy with it.
Yep. You don't want to risk too much on that. That is a responsibility that you choose to take on. Just like we were saying with gems, they're probably less risky than picking your own infrastructure or whatever, but that is technical debt or risk or whatever as well. So yeah, have to be thoughtful about these things. Sleep on it before you make a decision.
Yes, or don't and then wing it. If you want to go online and spend a lot of money trying to fix your mistakes.
Yeah. Are you talking about using MongoDB?
I mean,
shots fired.
If you want a name drop like that, you know.
All right. Well, I have to run. So it's good chatting with you this week. We didn't even mention that Jason wasn't here, but you guys will be in person recording at RailsConf without me.
And RubyConf.
I'll be sad. RubyConf, yes. I'm going to RailsConf, so that was...
See you there.
We're definitely going to record there, but yeah, enjoy RubyConf soon. I'm jealous, but yeah.
It'll be an interesting experience. Excited. Got one more recording until then.
Sounds good. Well, have a good weekend, and I guess we'll catch you next week.
Yes, sir. See ya.